Hombre, porque es una provincia muy bonita, con unos paisajes espectaculares, con un clima estupendo todo el año y porque los malagueños les vamos a tratar muy bien.
You're listening to the Cycling Podcast at the Vuelta a España in association with Rafa. Today we are in Alaurín de la Torre.
Hello, I'm Lionel Burney, and I'm with Fran Reyes.
Hello, Lionel. Hello, dear listeners.
Now, Fran, we heard Luis Angel Mate there imploring our listeners to all visit Malaga. What did he say?
Well, he said this is a beautiful region with spectacular landscapes and a great weather all year long. And on top of that, we, the people from Malaga, are going to be very gentle with them.
Lovely. Luis Angel Mate, one of the men of the day again today. Yesterday he was in the break, took the King of the Mountains jersey very much on home roads. On home roads again today, really, because we were out of the back of Malaga again. He'll have known all of these roads like the back of his hand. Where exactly are we?
Well, right now we are in Alaurín el Grande, which is a town like 30 kilometers north of Malaga. It's already countryside, despite this is not enclosed in the mountains that yesterday Caminito del Rey, Ardales, was. We began from Mijas, but a town that is basically divided in two halves. One half is inland, the other half is on the beach. They brought us to the seaside, but I didn't get to see any waves, to hear the seagulls. Yeah.
Well, I nearly made a terrible mistake this morning because I looked in the road book and I saw we're going to Mijas. So I put Mijas into the sat nav and I'm heading away from the coast here. I knew I had to go around Fuengirola. And I had to pull over and check, and that was when I realised the stage was actually starting at Mijas Playa, so down on the beach. Rookie mistake,
yeah,
Fran.
Rookie mistake, because, you know, if you had done like Richard and had come to the Vuelta Andalucía this year, you would have learned that Mijas, that whenever they say Mijas for a start for a cycling race, they say Mijas Costa. Richard and I were there to see Chris Froome doing his first pedal strokes after the salbutamol controversy.
So that was the Ruta del Sol, wasn't it, way back in February? I'm not used to travelling around in this part of Spain. And also I'm on my own in the cycling podcast car. I haven't got anyone to navigate for me. I'm a lone wolf. I'm doing my best, Fran. Well, Luis Mate was in the break for Cofidis today, stage 3 from Mijas Playa to Alaurín de la Torre. Mate was joined by Antonio Molina of Caja Rural, Nans Peters of AG2R, Pierre Hollande, again of EF Education First, Jordi Simon of BH, and Hector Saez of Euskadi, who also was in the break yesterday. A real lumpy old stage, another one. Well, I saw Nicholas Roach on Twitter say, I love these sprint stages that have mountains in them. There was a 20k climb at the start. It was lumpy all day. Some of the scenery was absolutely stunning again. And then the race really kind of kicked off when a four-man counter move went clear. Victor Campanets, Lucas Pustelberger, Yellow Wales and Alexis Gougier, some real firepower in there. And roughly at the time that little counter move formed, Jordi Simon went off the front of the break, and it was a real kind of it was like a chase on the track almost. You had the one man up front, then you had the break, then you had the pursuers, then you had the bunch. It all kind of came back together on the run into the town. Postelberger then made a really strong move on his own. But he paid for the effort of first of all getting up to the break and then trying to go solo. He actually sat up with around 6.5 kilometres to go as they went round a roundabout, or as he went round a roundabout. But I guess his move was not just to try and win the stage, but it was to take the pressure off Bora Hansgrohe when it came to the chase. Anyway, that all set up a sprint finish, and it was a kind of chaotic one at times. No one really had control of it, and it came down to a showdown between two Italians. Elia Viviani won ahead of Giacomo Nizzolo of Trek Segafredo. Viviani winning for Quickstep, where Laurence De Plus couldn't quite manage it yesterday. Viviani won 4 stages of the Giro earlier this season, his first stage win in the Vuelta here. Peter Sagan was third, Nasser Buhani fourth. Mikhail Kwiatkowski of Team Sky still in the red jersey ahead of Alejandro Valverde. Kwiatkowski also has the points and combined jerseys, and so they will be worn by Valverde and De Ploes respectively. And Mate is in the King of the Mountains. He extended his lead significantly today. As you said yesterday, Fran, you predicted that he would be in the break again, and he was. But what did you make of the stage, and in particular the finish?
Well, of the finish, the first thought that springs to my mind is that today Elia Viviani won for Quickstep. He had a great lead out by Michał Morkau, who is beginning to have a strong candidacy, a strong case to be considered the best lead-out rider in the world, at least the most dominant one. And, seeing that last year it was Matteo Trentin who was a dominant sprinter racing for Quickstep, today he was 8th at the sprint, one can't help but feel that it's actually Quickstep team they want to win and not that much the rider. Because every year they manage to find the right talent in order to keep this dominant position in very well-picked moment of the season. They know that in the Vuelta the sprinting field is not usually as strong as the Tour de France, and they always have a nice sprinter to come here and swipe some victories out.
Yeah, you say Michael Mukku, the Danish rider, was really the only guy with Viviani at the finish. I mean, Quickstep had done quite a lot of work earlier on in the stage, but we certainly not seeing sprint trains here like we would see in the Tour de France. Is that just because there's not the resources here, or because the stages are too hard, or is it because teams can't necessarily put all of their resources behind one objective? They're not just going to go for sprint stage wins.
Also, the bodies at this point of the season are beginning to be depleted. So putting all the eggs in one basket is a big risk, because most of the riders, 90% of the peloton, is coming here on a second or third peak of their shape. So that's why they choose to diversify their goals. And sometimes the teams come to this race with 8 riders thinking that they are in good shape to attack the Vuelta, and find themselves with 2-3 riders out of shape right from the beginning. In this race also there is a particular factor that doesn't have that much to be with the time of the season as much as with the time of the year. It is pretty hot in Spain right now, and some cyclists don't cope well with that. Today I was speaking to some riders after the finish about the time when the gruppetto of sprinters was dropped. There was a big group with several fast guys like Max Walshite from Team Sunweb that was left behind on the Category 1 climb that was ridden from 25 to 45 kilometers of the stage. And they were dropped there effectively, but some riders told me that it was not that much because of the pace, it was not that much because of the terrain, but above all, because of the heat. So, yeah, that plays a factor, and that makes sprint trains be teams less consistent, and thus the sprint trains.
From grand tours to group rides, the Champs-Élysées to coffee shops, Rafa exists to celebrate the world's most beautiful sport.
Thank you very much to Rafa for sponsoring the cycling podcast and enabling us to be here, giving daily coverage of the Vuelta, as we did the Giro d'Italia and the Tour de France earlier in the year. Another plug for the cycling podcast Féminin, Rafa Women's 100 ride on Saturday the 15th of September. It kicks off at 9 a.m. from Cadence Performance, which is at Annerley Hill in southeast London. SE19 is the postcode, and the ride will be led by cycling podcast listener Hannah Nicklin, and she promises it will be a very inclusive ride. There will be, much to Daniel's consternation, although I can't see what the fuss is about, there will be cafe stops en route. Sounds very civilized to me. It will be a hilly ride because that part of the country is quite hilly, but Hannah says no rider will be left behind, and basically if you can ride 50k you can ride 100, and well, it sounds to me like the sort of ride that if you've not ridden 100 kilometers before, well, it sounds like the sort of ride that would be the perfect way to reach three figures. So if you want to join that ride, go to rafa.cc and you can find out the details of all of the Rafa women's rides that are going on around the world on the 15th of September. Well, another rider you spoke to at the start this morning was turned out to be second on the stage, Giacomo Nizzolo of Trek Segafredo, still waiting for his first Grand Tour stage win. But let's hear what he said to you this morning.
So here we are in the start of Micas with Giacomo Nizzolo, one of the main sprinters of this Vuelta a España. Tell me, Giacomo, in which condition do you arrive to this Vuelta?
My shape was improving in the last weeks, so I feel not bad. Yesterday I was not super because of the heat, and I hope today it's gonna be better.
Yeah, but I guess most of the peloton was feeling
this
shock of the heat, right?
Yeah, I think so. Yesterday I saw many guys very, very tired from the heat, and yeah, I mean it's something we have to live with in this kind of races. So maybe we get to use in a few days.
Who do you expect to be the strongest rivals for you in these sprints?
Yeah, Sagan, Viviani, Buani, Trentin, then even Popper. I mean, it's a good feel of sprinters here in Vuelta this year because of there are many, many chances of sprint. So a good bunch of sprints.
So Nizzolo there backing up what you said there, Fran, not just about the heat, but also the depth of the sprinting field here. Peter Sagan, of course, is not quite the same Peter Sagan who was in the Tour de France a month or so ago. So it's going to be interesting. I mean, everything goes out of the window, doesn't it, when the stages are as tough as this. It's not a flat-out sprint stage like we saw in the Tour de France, where Dylan Groenewegen won two in a row without even going over so much as a fourth category climb on those 2 days in the Tour. These stages are something completely different, and in some races they would be classed as almost mountain stages, and yet we see the likes of Viviani and Buhani, Nizzolo, Sagan all up there at the finish. It's about surviving the climbs first and seeing whether you have enough in your legs at the finish. Fran, you also spoke to Lucas Postelberger of Bora Hansgrohe. Well, let's hear what he said at the finish.
I was following the move from the Lotto guys, and yeah, at some point Victor was unlucky, he crashed in the distance, so I was on my own, and I said, okay, what I do now, I don't wait for half a minute, so I give it a go and see where I end up. So, but it was 5Ks too long, so yeah.
See it pretty close, you got to enjoy yourself in the head of the race and gave a free ticket for your teammates at the peloton.
Yeah, this is true. Actually, nobody had to chase anymore, so we were free of work, and I hope it was good for the guys at least. They saved some energy for the sprint and for the final.
What did you make of Postelberger's move? And I mean, he looked strong, and then suddenly he didn't look quite so strong.
Well, I mean, I think the most interesting part about Postelberger's move is, on one hand, that he basically did it to give a free ride to his teammates on the bunch, and on the other, picking up from what you were saying before hearing from Postelberger, these stages are different to Tour de France stages. There are less of a showdown between sprints and their team, sprinters and their teams, and more of an entertaining show, several hours long, where there are a lot of alternatives. And luckily, teams are beginning to understand that it's up to them to grab the opportunities and try and move and shake things up. Teams are not that consistent, so an individual rider or several individual riders with strength and freshness on their legs, they can go a long way and even make it to the finish.
And I suppose the other thing is the bunch cannot take it for granted that the break will come back. That break, it wasn't super, super strong guys. I mean, riders who from the Spanish Pro Conti teams, not perhaps used to riding at the World Tour level, but they'll be used to this kind of diet of the Spanish stage races. This will be nothing unusual for them. But it was quite telling, the phase of the race when the bunch wanted to close that gap down. They didn't want to leave it to chance. They didn't want to have this sort of final, not even a categorized climb here, but a lot of climbing before the intermediate sprint, which was on the top of a hill. I mean, it's typical Spanish stuff. Entertaining kind of racing as well, and we're going to see a lot more of that in this first week.
Yeah, probably. I mean, the only stage that is comfortable and sprinters suit it completely for sure and for complete is the stage to San Javier in Murcia. It goes along the coastal line, and it's probably going to be windy, and we might see the possibility of some echelons if there is a wind strong enough and there is a team willing to force this kind of move. And then in Almaden, stage 8 on Saturday, it seemed like a sprinter suited course, but it can offer a few surprises as well, because there is some lumpy terrain on the way.
The Cycling Podcast is supported by Science in Sport.
Kiss goodbye to stomach problems with the world's first truly isotonic gel. Science in Sport Go Energy Isotonic. Before you hit the wall, hit back.
Science in Sport, fueled by science.
Thank you to Science in Sport for sponsoring the Cycling Podcast. If you want to get 25% off everything from Science in Sport, go to scienceinsport.com, fill your basket with gels and energy drinks and anything else that takes your fancy, and then put in the code SISCP25. That's SISCP25. Now, Fran, I'm going to leave you briefly. I need to catch up with Daniel for the segment of the podcast that I think he's going to call the best segment of the podcast. This is already becoming a regular feature of the Cycling Podcast at the Vuelta, Daniel, the middle section with Daniel Freeb. Hello, Daniel.
Have I got a name? Is there a name for this segment? I've demanded that before and been called a diva. That was at the Tour, wasn't it, a couple of years ago?
The best section of the podcast with Daniel Freeb. We're sitting in an outdoor basketball court here with a slightly strange plastic floor. Looks like that might aid the players as they bounce their ball.
Lionel, we must be very careful we don't get electrocuted, not only because there's a storm brewing overhead, which, well, it's already unleashed some rain on us, didn't it, at the finish, but because I was reading about this town, Al Haurin de la Torre, which is an Arabic name or Moorish-influenced name, and one of the big issues for the local people here in Las Vegas has been very, very, very high-voltage electrical plants somewhere outside the town, and which are considered to pose a grave risk to the inhabitants should anything ever go wrong one day.
Wow. I mean, I'm, as you know, any kind of, well, everything sets me off, sets my anxiety off, ferries, wild dogs, the possibility of power plants blowing up.
Why are there so many dogs in Andalusia?
I don't know.
Matt White will have a view on this, surely. I asked Fran about this earlier, because I got chased by two dogs on my run this morning, and several other dogs tried to chase me but were fortunately being kept behind wire fences. Not that kind of wire, not electrical wire. But yeah, an extraordinary number of dogs in Andalusia.
More than in Sicily.
Fran suggested it had something to do with canine contraception or the lack thereof in Andalusia.
Wow, pick that up.
When you talk about sterilisation, can you talk about contraception? No, different thing.
Different things, yeah, different things. I'll have to pick this up with Fran at some point. I wanted to pick up on something from yesterday. Laurence Depluse of Quickstep, his near miss at the finish, didn't talk an awful lot about what a difficult year he's had. He had a really spectacular crash at Il Lombardia at the end of last season, went over a railing and fell around 30 feet, recovered from that, and then was training in South Africa with his teammate Petter Vakoch, and they were hit by a lorry, and he didn't start his season until May, and it's emerged in the last few days that De Ploes is leaving Quickstep. He's joining Team Jumbo, as Lotto NL Jumbo will become next season. And I was talking to our Belgian colleague Hugo Kurlewitz about this morning, and he said that he'd had a conversation with De Ploes about this transfer. And De Ploes asked him whether or not, you know, what do you think? Do you think it's a good move? And Kurlewitz made the point that it's a strange move for an up-and-coming GC-type rider going to Team Jumbo, where they already have crowds like Roglic, Bennett, Tolhoek. And then it brought something Richard had said to my mind about how Lotto NL Jumbo are trying to kind of almost mimic Team Sky. And they're trying to copy the same way of riding, I guess, by having a team packed with GC type riders. It'll be interesting to see how that plays out. But Quickstep, near miss yesterday, but they got their reward today with Elia Viviani winning a stage of the Vuelta, his first stage of the Vuelta after, well, a handful, four at the Giro.
Yeah, and I think it's his 16th win of the season, a bit of an annus mirabilis it's turning into. I wouldn't say any of the other frontline sprinters in the World Tour have had an unqualified success this year, except for Viviani. They've all had their various setbacks. And Viviani, well, this sort of continues a bit of a crescendo in his career. And it's, you know, it's quite a heartwarming story in the sense that, you know, I remember him when he was at Liquigas. I remember talking to him at Paris-Nice one year in about 2011 or 12. And he really considered himself to be an underdog in not only in the sprinting game, but also as far as his track ambitions were concerned. And he was not getting much funding from the Italian Federation, but track cycling was something, indoor cycling was something he was doing out of personal passion. And it was a labour of love for him. And then eventually got his gold medal in the Olympics, didn't it? You'll have to tell me, well, was it the Omnium? The Omnium! I'm very proud of myself for remembering that in 2016. And he made what has turned out to be a pretty shrewd move from Team Sky to Quickstep this time last year. It was kind of a swap deal with David de la Cruz, wasn't it? Which way did that go? I remember hearing at the time that Patrick Lefebvre contacted Dave Brailsford about Viviani, and Lefebvre offered him De La Cruz, something along those lines anyway.
Almost like a football transfer, De La Cruz plus cash for Viviani.
They were swapped like a pair of Panini stickers, in fact. Anyway, it's worked out incredibly well for him, hasn't it? It was probably the right time in his career to become the main sprinter, although he's actually got a lot of competition at Quickstep with Gaviria, but certainly to ride major tours, which he wasn't doing at Team Sky. That was the main issue with him riding for Team Sky. And this year he was pretty dominant at the Giro in sprints, and it looks as though it might be that way in the Vuelta as well.
Yeah, they were very more or less very well organised at the Giro, weren't they? There was that one day that Sam Bennett won on the motor racing circuit at Imola, where Quickstep really, well, they lost the plot that day, didn't they? They didn't know where Viviani was, and Viviani didn't take control of the situation. What was interesting today was that Quickstep did a lot of the chasing at a key point in the race just to bring everything back under control, but they really left him to his own devices on the run-in. I mean, it was a real kind of, no one was holding the reins at all on the run-in, and at times, even with sort of 3-4 kilometres to go, the whole bunch was sort of spread across the road, which indicated two things: one, that no one wanted to take control, and two, the pace wasn't all that high. So it was an unusual sprint in that respect.
Yeah, although I think Mirko pronunciation police, do what you got to do. I'm never sure about his name.
Mirko.
I think Mirko did a pretty decent job. I spoke to him at the finish, actually. He talks about the fact that he likes it. He enjoys doing a lead out when the peloton's very tired, which they were today, because it was a pretty lumpy day, and 3,000 metres of climbing. They didn't take it too... they didn't go too fast for the majority of the stage, but the last 40 kilometres were tough, weren't they? The pressure was really on, and I think that's what everyone expected when we were speaking to riders this morning. They said the last 40 kilometres would be a bit like a classic, and that's what it was. But it was quite unusual in the sense that for a Vuelta sprint, in the sense that it did become quite kind of chaotic, almost Tour de France like in the last 4 or 5 kilometres for a time. I remarked on the fact to one of my colleagues earlier that you very rarely see crashes in Vuelta sprints, which is a very good thing, of course, which is partly down to the different nature, isn't it, of sprints here. They don't have big lead out trains. Viviani was just the fastest. I say he was the fastest. I spoke to Nasser Bouhanni at the finish as well, and he thinks that he could have got very close to Viviani or even beaten him if he hadn't had a problem with his chain at 600 metres to go. I'm not sure about that.
That's the old, I could have won if I'd won. I mean, yeah, there's always a problem with somebody's chain when they don't win, isn't there? Or the gears didn't work or got boxed in. That's the nature of sprinting and bike racing.
If my gran was had wheels, she'd be a wheelbarrow.
That's right. Well, this morning I spoke to Ian Boswell of Team Katusha. He was our diarist at the Tour de France and made a very entertaining diary of his debut Tour de France. Friends of the podcast can listen to that by signing up at thecyclingpodcast.com/friends. It's £15 for the year. I wanted to ask Ian about Ilner Zakarin's crash and the after effects of that. And I also asked for the definitive verdict on whether or not they considered Zakarin's Tour de France to be a success. But Ian Boswell started with a comment about the cycling podcast helping him get to sleep at night.
He's also got a good Pavel Tonkov story for me, he said. He pulled over after his time trial, in fact. He was going about 60 kilometres an hour at the time, and he slammed on the brakes and he said, "I've got a great Tonkov story for you, but I'll tell you in the next few days."
He told Richard that story, I think it's one that's not for publication. Anyway, sorry about that, listeners. We can't share the Pavel Tonkov story, but this is Ian Boswell of Katusha this morning.
I have to get on the podcast so I can have something to take a nap to on the way to the start. Let's make a long one, then I can take a good nap.
Oh, very flattering. One of the most flattering things we've ever been told, I think.
Yeah, well, I think I've said it before. I don't know, something about, maybe it's the combination of your voices and the mundane, I guess I've done the race, so I know what happened. So listening to it's kind of like a daydream.
Yeah, very interesting. Glad to be of service. I was going to ask you, did it feel like only yesterday that you were unwinding in Paris after the Tour de France, and now here you are kind of back at work?
Definitely. I was actually just messaging with my fiance, and I think the buzz of the tour is kind of over. You know, being an American, I haven't been back to the US. I was there at California, but I haven't been home to my house since Christmas time. I was up for the Vuelta since the beginning of the year. It's always on my program. I'm excited to be here, but I guess the reality of, like, you know, all these people back home being excited for you doing the tours, that buzz has all kind of died, and now the cruel reality that there's still 3 weeks of racing to go, plus, you know, the Worlds after that.
And the Vuelta's no picnic, is it, as we saw yesterday? I mean, Ilner Zakarin hit the deck. Were you on hand? What happened? Do you know? Have you managed to piece together what happened now?
Funny enough, I did the Vuelta in 2015, and I think Palucci crashed in that same turn, so it wasn't the first time I was going to get down in that turn. And I actually saw it coming. I was like, oh, I remember this turn. And I think some Sunweb guys crashed, and then Ilnor locked up his wheel or ran into them and went over the bars. He's Russian. He's tough. So he got back on his bike and, you know, fought to the end. I was there with him on the final climb, and about 2 or 3K to go, I think the pain, you know, and, you know, getting out of the saddle really hurt him. So I waited for him and paced him to the line to try to minimize his losses. But it... Yeah, I mean, it's tough. You know, I think he came in here with high aspirations as well, and was feeling good. So, you know, try to manage today and just really see how he feels. Nothing's broken from the x-rays and scans, so.
Lastly, in the podcast just before the Vuelta, I was talking about Zakarin's tour and saying that probably spirits were pretty high with the way he finished. And, you know, the old cliche, it's not how you start, it's how you finish. Came really good in the final week. And I suggested that the team would be happy. And Daniel kind of shot me down and said, have we decided whether or not Zakarin had a good tour? What's the feeling from inside the team?
I think all things considered, how the tour went, you know, with losing our sprinter and not winning a sprint stage, finishing with four riders, I think the last couple of days we were happy as a team, and, you know, not so much for the result, but I guess just our attitudes and how we raced. We didn't give up. We didn't kind of, you know, just try to ride to Paris. We actually tried to animate the race, and we still raced for something to the end. And I think, you know, in cycling, that goes a long way to show your charisma and what you're, you know. Yeah, results are something, but I think how you race as a team is also important, especially from within the team.
So according to Ian Boswell, today was going to be key for Zakarin as he begins to make a recovery from a heavy fall, nothing broken, but a bit bashed up, and with a difficult old finish tomorrow. I guess tomorrow now becomes even more it will tell us whether or not Zakarin's going to suffer any ill effects from that crash.
A lot of GC guys lost bits and bobs of time yesterday, didn't they? I was just browsing through the results earlier on and didn't realise just quite how much damage had been done by that final climb yesterday.
You needed to listen to the tale of the etapa.
I did. Unfortunately, I was eating tapas at that time. Napalm, how is Superman Lopez going to go tomorrow? Because one of my televisual colleagues, Nelson from Caracol, from Colombian national TV, he's looked bereft the last few days because Superman Lopez has stopped talking to Caracol, not because they've annoyed him or because he doesn't like the cut of Nelson's jib, very, very affable fellow, in fact, Nelson. But I think he's really feeling the pressure. He's really feeling that it's a very stressful position that he's in, going in as one of the favourites to win this Vuelta. And it reminded me of a conversation I had with Beppe Martinelli, the Astana DS, at the end of the Giro, which, of course, Superman Lopez finished in third place. But Martinelli said then that the first week and first 10 days of the Giro, he'd really struggled as well with the same issue. Being the undisputed leader of the team and also having to give orders to his teammates is not something that he likes to do.
Well, we will find out tomorrow. He was a bit Clark Kent yesterday rather than Superman, wasn't he? Sort of anonymous, no one would pick him out as being anything special. But Fran Reyes said on last night's podcast that the hectic approach and the twisty roads on that approach to that climb weren't really his cup of tea, so...
It's one of the most physically incongruous nicknames of all time, isn't it, Superman? He's not really a sort of dashing, tall, dark and handsome, chisel-jawed Adonis, is he, with a cape? More like Danger Mouse.
I'm going with Clark Kent. Anyway, before we let you go, Daniel, the other news from the world of cycling, it's very hard when we're on the Grand Tours to kind of keep abreast of the rest of the news. The Deutschland Tour concluded at the weekend. There's all sorts of other racing going on. The Tour of Britain starts at the weekend. But something that did catch our ears and has certainly made a bit of a splash here at the Vuelta is the demise of the Aqua Blue team, the Irish pro team, who were in the Vuelta a year ago and did very well. They were in a lot of breaks. Stefan Denifil won at Los Machucos. Remember that incredible kind of pursuit between Denifil and Contador, and he held off Contador to win the stage. And it looked like, well, this is a team that has an interesting business model, a sort of an online retailer of not just cycling gear but other sort of sports gear as well, I believe. The idea was to try and make the team self-funding. And earlier in the summer, there was a rumour of a merger with the Willems Verandas team. Sorry, the Verandas Willems team, the Belgian team of Wout van Aert, the cyclocross and classic sensation. And that looked like quite an interesting potential merger. Aqua Blue announced this merger, and then within very short order, the Belgian team said, no, there's nothing to see here. And then it all went quiet. Rick Delaney has not responded to our approaches to ask him to clarify what's going on. And then this morning, they announced on Twitter that the team is stopping. And... it's caught the riders by surprise because I gather they were completely in the dark until this morning as well. They found out just a few days before the Tour of Britain, which obviously will be a big objective for them. But it highlights a lot of things, not least the difficulty of the business model. When a team can come to a Grand Tour, do well, I mean, you can't do much better as a wildcard team than get in the breaks and win a stage and then find yourself empty-handed the next year. But what's your take on it, Daniel?
Well, I think it's symptomatic of the fact that the World Tour and the notion of the World Tour has almost succeeded in what I think was one of the sort of occult goals or hidden goals of the World Tour, which was to almost kill off the lower category and create an elite, a closed shop, because the tier below the World Tour should be or is the professional Continental Division, which is what Aqua Blue were in. Those are the teams that look for wild cards for the to the major tours. But to operate well at that level, you really have to have a budget that's not too far away from what the World Tour teams have. The big difference being that you have zero guarantees about participation in races. And, you know, we're talking about a climate in which, as we've mentioned before on the podcast, we suspect that for some of the World Tour races, the Grand Tours in particular, there might be financial sort of incentives offered to the Grand Tour organisers to give wild cards out. We think that's happened in the past. Those teams in that Pro Continental bracket are really in a difficult position, and it creates a bit of a cliff face on the edge of the World Tour, on the outer edge of the World Tour. Riders who kind of fall off that carousel, then there's not an awful lot. There aren't an awful lot of teams operating at a level close to World Tour now for those riders. Often, I think this will be the case, unfortunately, with some of the Aqua Blue riders, they'll be contemplating retirement, and it's understandable that there aren't many backers or team managers that want to invest, you know, upwards of €5 million a year with a vague hope of doing the races that they want to do, in fact.
Yeah, and the big problem for the riders that have been left, well, it's so late in the year now, isn't it? Transfers are still being announced, but you know, the pressure for spots in the World Tour teams has never been greater, because of course the Grand Tours have reduced from 9 to 8 riders, which means that the teams overall, if they haven't already, will be starting to reduce the overall sizes of their rosters. And there's some real talent on that Aqua Blue squad. You know, some of the riders that will be looking for something else: Adam Blythe, Larry Warbass, Conor Dunn, the Irish champion, among plenty of others, Lassie, Norman Hansen. It's really late in the day for those riders to be told that they've got nothing for next year. And George Bennett, among several riders who tweeted their kind of dismay on those riders' behalf, really. But we shall see what happens. We've actually got plans for a rider's diary from one of the Aqua Blue riders at the Tour of Britain, which will be released after the Tour of Britain, so stand by for that. I'm sure there'll be a lot more on what is happening with the team in that. But you mentioned the wild cards here, Daniel, and one of them, Cofidis, is a big partner of the Vuelta. You see their banners up on the roadsides a lot, and the other three are Spanish teams. So, you know, it's not like you can really say, well, they're outrageous choices. It's just that on this occasion, Aqua Blue lost out, and it has really cost them dearly this season. So, Daniel, that's the end of the best section with Daniel Freeb. We'll see you again tomorrow.
Thanks, Lionel.
Don't forget to listen to our morning show, Kilometer Zero, supported by The Economist, Monday, Wednesday and Friday mornings throughout the Vuelta a España.
We released our first Kilometer Zero of this Vuelta this morning. It was called Vuelta Vignette, and it's quite a meaty listen, actually. The four of us all told various stories that build up into a kind of potted history of the Vuelta, going right back to the origins of the race in 1935 and the disruption caused first by the Spanish Civil War and then the Second World War and then the economic difficulties that Spain experienced. Some stories may be familiar, but a little twist on them. Others you might not have heard before, but they all build up to kind of give a picture of what the Vuelta España is and how the modern race kind of has evolved out of all of that history. It's had quite an identity change, particularly 23 years ago when it shifted from a spring race into a late summer race. So if you would like to listen to that, it is in all the normal places. You may have noticed on social media the artwork that we've used to promote the episode Grand Tour Art. An artist called Annette Kelly is going to illustrate some of our Kilometer Zeros, and check them out at Grand Tour Art on social media. They are going to make some of the original artwork available. I think they're going to auction them for the Dave Rayner Fund and then sell prints with 50% of the profits going to the Dave Rayner Fund. So if any of those artworks catch your eye or take your fancy and you'd like to own a print, we'll work out exactly how that's going to happen as the Vuelta goes on. We've got some more illustrations coming as we release further episodes of Kilometre Zero. The next one will be on Wednesday morning. Now, Fran, we need to look forward to tomorrow because we are going on to your home roads. Tomorrow night we'll be staying in Granada, which is I think it's the pick of the cities down in this part of Spain. A beautiful, almost medieval town centre in Granada. And we are making our way up a climb that I'm not terribly familiar with, but you must be.
Yeah, the climb to Sierra del Alfaguara, the other side of the Sierra Nevada, not that well known, because in fact it hasn't been visited by any professional race, as far as I am aware and as far as I have checked. So yeah, quite a novelty for professional cycling. I've climbed it several times with some friends. Last time it was last Saturday. I can maybe put the Strava file online so you can check how slow I am. but yeah, it's a pretty, above all, it's a beautiful climb. I wouldn't say it is outrageously difficult. It only has a kilometer that is really steep, like 10% average on a very merciless road, because it is more or less white, the surface is not smooth, and the sun falls completely on top of you as you are riding. So you basically get cooked because you are going slow, climbing with all the gear you have already on, and it's very demanding. Afterwards, the climb gets beautiful. You have several hairpins with a gentle gradient of maybe 7-9 until 2 kilometers to go when you begin to run into the forest. At this point, the climb eases up, and with the half kilometer to go, I think more or less, you turn right to go all the way to the natural park. It kicks a bit up the gradient, and that's where the showdown for the stage victory will come. As for the outcome, I think it depends mostly on how much they push the pace on that steep kilometer. That's where most of the harm can be done. From then on, if there are 12 riders and there is one of them determined to tow the rest of the group riders all the way up to the park, he can do it.
So, I mean, the thing that tells me this is going to be a tricky finish is the Vuelta organisers have come round this afternoon and said only a certain number of cars will be allowed up to the top. Now, that either tells me that it's narrow and steep, or that it's a road to nowhere and there's no infrastructure up there. So it's that rather than the fact that the road is particularly, it's not like a mini Angliru or something like this.
No, it's just the fact that this road ends up on the natural park. From then on, you can go on very beautiful walks. There are like, I don't know, like 20 options. And I can tell you that my girlfriend, in our third date, she brought me there to Alfaguara to have a 7 kilometer walk through the forest. So yeah, it is going to be meaningful for me.
Oh, lovely. That's very nice, Fran. I'm looking forward to it because, I mean, yesterday was absolutely stunning overlooking the reservoir, so we'll have some lovely views up there. We'll have to decide what we do tomorrow night, whether we record our podcast up there with a beautiful countryside or whether we come down into Granada and meet up with Daniel and record in the city. So we've got choices tomorrow. If you had to say which kind of riders it's going to suit, I mean, is there going to be a real serious shake-up? Is Kwiatkowski going to be okay? Valverde will be okay? I mean, can you see much of a shake-up overall?
Well, I can see that several contenders losing a chunk of time that will be more harmful than the one that it was lost in Camino del Rey. Because what the GC riders lost in Camino del Rey was more or less expected and was not much because of the strength, but because of the gaps, because of the road, because of several other factors not related to shape, you know, to the body. Tomorrow, it's going to be head-on into the climb, a climb where the technical difficulty, neither on the climb nor on the approach, is not high. So the engines will prevail. The rider that loses time tomorrow is probably one step below to the ones that make it into the time of the stage winner. As for the type of rider, I assume that the 15 best climbers will be together after that steep kilometer and after the hairpins, and it will be the punches of them, or the canniest, to get the victory. So I expect another sprint between Valverde and Kwiatkowski.
Interesting. Well, we will see whether... So what we were saying yesterday about Miguel Angel Lopez not enjoying the twisty-turny approach to Caminito del Rey, that won't be a factor for him tomorrow. So we will find out whether he is Superman or Clark Kent tomorrow. Now, Fran, the big piece of news as far as Spanish cycling goes today is that the Izaguirre brothers, Gorka, who is the Spanish champion, and Jon, who is not the Spanish champion, are on the move from Bahrain Merida to Astana. There'd been some speculation about whether or not they would be staying or going over the summer, but they're going as a pair to Astana. This is a big deal in Spanish cycling, right?
Yeah. I mean, at this point, the Izaguirre brothers are probably two of the top five riders in Spanish cycling. I mean, they are consistent all season long. They have managed to make a name for themselves, not as domestics, but as proper contenders for 1 week races and even from 1 day races. And this move has been pretty followed because, they were not quite that happy at Valle Merida with the material that was solved, because especially, they loved it, time traveling. That's their best thing, the thing they love most. And when they switch it from the Canyon of Movistar team to the Merida of Bahrain, they found Merida to be an inferior bike. So their results in time trials were slightly worse. They felt they lost several races because of that, and that rendered them not really happy. Luckily, there was a huge change on that. Before the Spanish National Championships, they were given the new Merida time trial bikes, and that made them improve significantly. They were indeed quite proud and quite adamant that they had helped build this new bike, as they got the gold and the bronze medal, I think it was, on the time trial of the Spanish National Championships. But anyway, I can imagine that the fact that Bahrain Merida can offer 2 year deals, and because the Kingdom of Bahrain sponsorships is ending at the end of 2019, to have played a factor. They were behind the chased by the two oil rich teams in the World Tour peloton, the other two oil rich teams, Astana and UAE Team Emirates. And UAE Team Emirates, indeed, they thought they had them in the back. They even told some journalists that they were taking them on board, but late move, they have gone to Astana. Interestingly, also, Mikel Landa is always on discussions with the Astana team, former team of him, and one that still has pretty good memories of his quality and his capacity of being a Grand Tour winner. Spanish journal, Spanish newspaper Marca published yesterday a video interview with Alexander Vinokurov, on which he literally said that he was going to take Mikel Landa on board. He was willing to take Mikel Landa on board, and it would be either in 2019 or in 2020.
Now, Landa has a contract with Movistar for 2019, right? So this is quite a hostile move by Vinokurov.
Yeah, it's like, are they going to buy him out of the contract or what? Well, he said that he would respect the contract, but that if there was a possibility, he would grab him as soon as possible.
This is like a football transfer, isn't it, where the rumour comes first and then everyone gets together and talks about how they can make it happen. So, you know, who knows? That might come out. Would it suit Movistar to lose Landa? I mean, I mean, it's so difficult to know what goes on in the minds of the people at Movistar. I mean, they have so much talent, but they don't seem to know how to put it all together in one season to get the best out of everybody.
Well, for Movistar, losing Mikel Landa would definitely be a blow. I mean, they have a lot of talent in their roster right now. They have Nairo Quintana, who, even if he has failed to deliver a Tour de France victory, which is what he was touted as being capable of, he's still a contender in every stage race he takes part on. They have Valverde, who is obviously beginning to decline. It's just logical.
He probably can't go much past 44 or 45 years of age, I would say.
Yeah, it's only like 7 years left of Valverde. We better enjoy them. So, and also they have Richard Carapaz and Marc Soler, who are very bright prospects for GTs. Richard Carapaz was fourth in the Giro. Marc Soler won Paris-Nice and was impressive in the Tour de France, working for their leaders. So, the firepower is not a problem. The problem might be that if Mikel Landa is to become the next big thing in Spanish cycling, they rather have him rather than letting him go to become a star in a foreign team. That wouldn't look good, being Movistar, the only World Tour Spanish team and sponsored by a company, Telefonica, Movistar, that is proud of endorsing the best athletes of pretty much every sport.
It's a really fascinating puzzle, this, with Mikel Landa. I mean, we saw him at Sky, looked so good in the Tour de France last year, but clearly wanted to have his own chances. We were talking at the start of the year as Landa as a potential Tour de France winner this year, but it remains a fact that probably his best form, his best results, came when he was an Astana rider, really. I mean, it would make sense to go back there. And then quietly, Vinokourov has built, well, if you had Lopez, the Izaguirre brothers, and Landa, suddenly they become a real force in the Grand Tours. It's going to be interesting to see how that all shakes out. And of course, well, Richard, I was speaking to a bit earlier today, and we might do something on this later this week, or perhaps you and Richard can talk about this. But the whole transfer season seems to be so disruptive. It's all going on in the background while there's a major race going on, and you do always wonder with the Vuelta how much the kind of the wheeler dealering is influencing the riders. You know, several riders that we know are leaving one team to join another. You know, have they got their heads fully on this race? Other riders will be negotiating their contracts still now, I'm sure. It's a really fascinating time in the season, but we'll see how all that shakes out over the next week or so. But I think, Fran, we need to get ourselves back down to Malaga, or I certainly do. It's my last night in Malaga. I'm looking forward to finding a slightly better restaurant than the one I ended up in last night, because I was a bit late and I ended up in an all-you-can-eat Asian buffet restaurant.
How can you do that in Malaga, in Spain? I mean, that's the worst mistake you can do. I mean, did you get a stomach flu? Because no.
Well, I've got an iron stomach, Fran. I mean, I can eat more or less anything without suffering. So I don't want to tempt fate. But no, I'm stuck out of the old town. So it was difficult for me last night because, I know Spain stays open very late, but I couldn't get into the town and back out again. But tonight I'm going to make sure I do. So,
well, I will give you some advice, definitely. And for Granada, don't think anything. I will bring you to the best place out there to have huevos rotos.
I'm looking forward to it, Fran. We will reconvene tomorrow evening in Granada, or maybe in the middle of nowhere in the national park. Who knows? But until then, thank you very much, Fran.
Thank you very much, Lionel.